Well, good morning, friends. Welcome to a glorious, winterish feeling day at last. I love this. And hey, this is week four of our series. And by the way, if you're wanting a Bible or some notes, there's a chance for you to kind of make some notes if you'd like to. Just sort of give a wave, a shout out, a nod, a wink, something to Jeff or Dimitri. They'll hand you a Bible and or this. We don't have this morning's text on the screen. It's too long. So if you don't have a Bible, grab a Bible and you can at least follow along when we get to it in a few minutes. And on this side, I think, are baskets. And if those folk on the end of the rows, if you don't mind grabbing the baskets and starting to pass them across. The baskets have little cards in them. They are really just communication cards. Again, if you have a prayer request, a need, maybe just a change of address, maybe you're visiting with us. We'd love to know who you are, and maybe there's something that some way we can serve you. Just grab a card, save it. You don't have to rush to fill it out now. Pop it in one of the boxes on the way out at the end of the service would be quite appropriate. Well, welcome to week four. Nate is going to be back next week. Woo! He will finish our series next week as we've had this sort of good news series to start the year. And I'm looking forward to hearing how he wraps it up as well. Everybody loves a good story, don't we? I do. Every year for Christmas, it's no surprise, Kim or somebody in the family will buy me the latest John Grisham story. Any other John Grisham fans? Good. 41 bestsellers. He's been writing for 150 years, still writing apparently. And somewhere between Christmas and New Year, I sit down, I try and steal a few hours, and I just read this sort of fiction novel. I love it. It's a getaway, and I have to finish it before New Year because my other work starts shortly again after that, and it's like, I don't have time for that then. So John Grisham's always one of my go-tos. If you read stories, you probably have a favorite genre. Maybe it's a romance novel, maybe it's a thriller. I used to love international espionage. Maybe you like historical novels. Maybe you read fantasy. Maybe you don't read at all. Someone said to me, I don't read, I just watch the movies when they come out. And that's entirely fine. Hey, we read stories to our kids to stimulate their imagination. Nothing I get greater joy than to say to Oliver, hey, want to sit down? Let me just read a story to you. I'm a zip home for lunch. Quick, let's just read a story. I get a kick out of that. We read stories for our own entertainment. That's what I do at Christmas. We read stories to put ourselves to sleep. Not unusual for me to wake up in the middle of the night, like at 2 a.m., and there's this little glow under the covers beside me. It's Kim reading a 99-cent download from Amazon. It's like, just to try and get herself back to sleep. Sometimes we read stories just to escape reality for a while, don't we? Well, stories in the ancient world functioned a little differently. In the ancient world, if you had the education and you had the money to afford the writing implements that you might need, you wrote stories to help people know how to live well. You wrote stories and recorded history largely for moral and ethical purposes. You expected people who read the story to somehow or other enter into the story. It wasn't just a curiosity, it wasn't just an escape, it certainly wasn't just entertainment. You were to see yourself in that story somehow. You were to learn from the story. You were to experience the story in your own way. I think of Jesus telling the story of the prodigal son, a story familiar to a lot of people. This prodigal son, this wasteful son. And at the end of the story, we're really expected, Luke expects us, Jesus expected us to say, hey, are you the son who goes off and wastes stuff in the far country but gets to come home? Or are you the rather self-righteous brother who stayed home all the time but really has a heart that's not toward home? Or sometimes are you the dad who needs to welcome someone back home, who's been in the far country for way too long? What does this story tell me about me? What does this story tell me about God? How does this story help me live better and differently? And so we're going to come to another story this morning that speaks, I think, to a human condition that's common to all of us. The truth of it is that most of us have different life experiences and different life circumstances. We all have different jobs. I don't think anybody else in this room has the job I have, nor do I have your job. We have different homes. We have different family backgrounds. We have different interests. We have different income. We have different resources. We have different skill sets. Man, I wish I could play a guitar and sing. I can't. We all look differently. I'd love to grow a beard like Nate does. You know, he can blow out one of these Bushman beards in about 3 weeks, and this is about 5 years of effort on my part. But there is something common to every man and woman in this room. Suffering. Suffering. And how we handle suffering is one of the greatest challenges of our human experience. Tim Keller once wrote that the ancient Greek philosophers believed that the very purpose of philosophy was to discover how to face evil, suffering, and death well. I don't know how successful they were in that venture, but they understood that that's really what it was all about. Because we all face evil, suffering, and death. The question is, how shall we face it and flourish? Hinduism says that suffering is caused by karma. Sometimes we use that word in a joking kind of way. Well, that was bad karma. Well, that was good karma. Karma simply teaches you get what you deserve. And the solution to your suffering is just to do right and hope that in your next reincarnated form, things will be better for you. Not a lot of hope for here and now. Buddhism says that suffering is an illusion. It's not real. That's why we all experience it so differently. And any struggle that we experience is the result of unmet desires or hopes. And the best thing you can do to minimize your suffering is to lessen your desires and eliminate your hope so that you can't be crushed. Detach yourself from the world. I have a word for that. It's called machine, not human being. Islam says that suffering is your destiny. Don't fight it, don't resist it, or you might find that you're resisting Allah himself. Just endure it. Accept it as your fate and do the best you can with it in this life. Secularism, which describes a large part of our culture, that is where we just push God right out of the picture, says suffering's an accident. Wrong time, wrong place, bad luck. And the way you handle suffering is just to find a better technique. Learn a new therapeutic technique. Take this medication. Screen people more carefully next time. Wear goggles in the workshop. Don't go out after dark. Just avoid accidents in the future. It's the best you can hope for. But otherwise, chin up, do your best. What does that look like in reality? Let me give you one example, the suffering of singleness and loneliness. And there are so many different forms of suffering. Hinduism would say, well, you must deserve it. If there's not a person for you, it's because you don't deserve a person. Oh, well. Karma. Buddhism says you can get over your loneliness by stop desiring companionship. Stop hoping for a partner and you won't suffer nearly as badly. Islam says it's your fate, just get used to it. Adjust, adapt. Don't wrestle with it. Secularism says make yourself more attractive, get on more dating apps, go to more social events, right? There's a technique, there's something you can do to maybe fix the problem yourself. And here is where the Christian gospel is so radically different. Here is why the gospel message of Jesus took off like a bushfire in the first century. Because it offered an extraordinary message about human suffering. From a Christian perspective, we might say that suffering is anything that violates or disrupts God's intended order for our lives. Simple definition. War and violence cause suffering. Sickness is a cause of suffering. Poverty is a cause of suffering. Drugs and alcohol can produce suffering. Broken marriages produce suffering. Death produces suffering, because all of these things are outside the plan, the order, the purpose, and the will of God. So they all qualify as suffering. It's one reason why the Jews would always greet and farewell one another with a single word, shalom. It's a word you've probably heard. Shalom is simply a word of blessing that speaks a blessing of peace and well-being. Order, peace, well-being to you. As I greet you, and order, peace, and well-being to you as I leave you. Because shalom is the opposite of suffering. So with all of that, let's jump briefly, ever so briefly, into a story in Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 5, verses 25 to 34. There was a woman there that day who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, says Mark. 12 years. She had suffered, there's the first use of that word, she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all that she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. Some of us know exactly how she feels. We've spent everything we've got, and we haven't gotten better, we've gotten worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. It's incredible, isn't it? Immediately, her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. Second use of that word. At once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, "Who touched my clothes?" "Well, you see the people crowding against you," his disciples answered, "and yet you ask, who touched me?" Luke is more specific. He says that Peter asked the question. I'm not surprised. It's always Peter, isn't it? Jesus kept looking around to see who'd done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, she came and she fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. And the story finishes with this line. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." A third use of that word in the New International Version. It's a story within a story. It's a biblical inception, if you like. Jesus had just crossed the Sea of Galilee again. It's not a long journey, perhaps an hour or two, depending on the wind. You know, it's not a long distance by any means. And he was probably glad to be back in Capernaum. It's kind of home. He leaves Nazareth. He pretty much moves to Capernaum, I'm certain. But the crowd is large. They wouldn't leave him alone. They're jostling. They're very close. It's not like there's a handful of people who are just wanting to chat with him. There's a crowd there, and they're bumping into him. He's trying to walk through. He's down by the seaside. And a guy by the name of Jairus comes to him. He's a local synagogue ruler. Everybody knows him, and that's why he gets named in Mark chapter 5. And Jairus comes to Jesus and says, "Oh, my young daughter, she's dying. Come and help her. If anyone can help her, you can help her. She's deathly sick. She mightn't last much longer. Come, Jesus, and help me." And you can imagine the whole crowd going, "Whoa, we're all going with him," right? Jesus starts heading toward Jairus' place. And as he's heading in that direction, there's a woman in the crowd, an unnamed woman who decides to take advantage of Jesus' proximity. And this unnamed woman who has been suffering from this bleeding for 12 years slips up behind him. We might easily imagine that she has endured what I'd call a triple stigma. Bless her heart. As a woman, she already had limited social status in ancient Israel. Maybe that's why she's not named. I'm kind of surprised that Jairus gets named and she's just a woman, right? Why not give her a name? Well, because she is a woman, and she has limited social status. As a woman with a bleeding problem, she now has no religious status. Like the leper that we talked about last week, she's ceremonially unclean all the time. She can't go near the rabbis or the teachers, the rulers, the worshippers. She can't go near the priests or the pilgrims. She's got to stay away from them, and they've got to cut a wide berth around her. But as a woman with a problem that extends beyond her monthly cycle, she no doubt had become a woman with a sin stigma as well. Kind of like having the cheese touch, if you ever watched The Diary of a Wimpy Kid. In Jewish thinking of that day, physical affliction was a sign of divine punishment. And for this to have persisted, she must be under some kind of discipline or curse from God. And maybe that's why she was nothing more than a woman in the eyes of the community. For 12 years, she'd been shunned. Doctors had failed to help her. She's dead broke, and her condition had only worsened for her. And she's desperate. She's desperate like many of us. Her physical affliction had become a social, emotional, financial, and spiritual affliction. In every way imaginable, at every level, she is suffering. And when she heard that Jesus was nearby, she thought, if I just touch his garments, I may get well. So she presses in towards Jesus, and when she's near enough to the hem of his robe, she reaches out and she touches it. I don't think she grabs it and yanks it, because the last thing she wants is any attention. I think she just kind of works her way with the crowd and then kind of just brushes up against it, because she knew that's all that might be needed. And immediately she's healed. Who isn't moved by that simple moment? Ah, this dear and desperate woman. She's deeply afraid. She had not rehearsed a request for healing. She hadn't planned to go and say anything to Jesus. Maybe she wasn't good with words. Maybe she didn't feel adequate. Maybe she didn't feel worthy. She didn't plan to say anything. She was going to touch him, and she was going to slip in quietly, and she was going to slip out just as quietly, if at all possible. But Jesus knew. When he asked who touched him, as if he didn't know, she steps forward with fear and trembling and tells him the whole truth, and something extraordinary happens. I mean, something more extraordinary than the physical healing. Jesus says, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." Three things very, very briefly and quickly this morning that Christ does for us. He restores our identity. He calls her daughter. Had anyone treated her with such compassion and inclusion for the past 12 years? Had any of her doctors shown her that kind of tenderness? You see, one of the first things that sometimes disappears in prolonged suffering is that we forget who we are. We forget who we are. Suffering can strip away our confidence. It can crush our spirit. It can distract us, it can deflate us, and every person in this room knows I'm telling the truth, because we've all suffered. I imagine that that dear woman had started to think of herself rather differently, but Jesus reminds her she is more than what everyone else in this little community has been saying about her for a very long time. She's not a woman, but a daughter. She's not that person, but she is a child of God. And friends, this morning, if this is your season of suffering, Jesus would say again, you are his son or daughter. Not simply a person with a problem. You are his family, not merely a kingdom slave. He invites us back in despite our rejection by others. And friends, that's glorious news. He restores our identity. He offers us shalom. Did you catch Jesus' words? Go in peace. Because peace is the opposite of suffering. He doesn't call us to fix ourselves. Once again, Jesus doesn't accuse her of any wrongdoing. As with the leper and basically every story in the Gospels, Jesus is unconcerned with how you got here and more concerned with where will you go from here. And while the crowd all whispered behind their hands about what she might have done to deserve this, about what kind of woman she must have always been that they didn't know about, Jesus says, you're a daughter. And we're turning the page and continuing to write the story. He didn't judge her. He simply met her where she was. He offered her a way forward that the doctors and the philosophers and the religious leaders of her day had never offered her. Number three, he heals our brokenness. Be freed from your suffering. Her physical suffering came to an end because Jesus did what nobody else could do. He healed body, mind, and soul. Again and again, I am thankful that healing is not reserved for the educated and the eloquent, for the clever, and those who are able to speak well for themselves. She didn't even want to say a word. And she receives healing from Jesus. Healing is not offered only to the deserving or the renowned. Sure, Jairus, I'll come with you, famous man that you are. And daughter, I will allow you to touch me and be healed. And friends, his hem continues to flow past us all. This is the profoundly good news of the gospel. Hinduism would have told this story differently. Hinduism would have said the woman must have deserved her affliction in some way. And the last thing Jesus would want to do is step in and mess with karma, this cosmic, universal balancing of good and evil. The last thing he should do is mess with that, or that might have brought bad karma on him. Well, there'd be no story like this in Hinduism. Buddhism would have told the story differently. It would have said her struggle wasn't real. What she needed to do was to let go of her desire for physical health and well-being, to let go of her hope for healing, and if she could just suppress her desires and her hopes, that somehow or other she wouldn't struggle nearly so much. Maybe you can hear little echoes of the advice you've been given from time to time. Islam would have told the story differently. It would have said this woman's suffering was her fate, and she simply needed to find a way to endure it. If anything, coming hoping to be healed and to mess with her fate was an act of faithlessness, not faith itself. Secularism would have told the story differently. It would have told us that the physical affliction was an accident of some kind, just pure bad luck. Too bad, so sad. Maybe you should borrow some more money. Maybe you should try some other doctors. Maybe you should get some surgery. Maybe you should try a new medication. Find a new therapy. But the story paints a dramatic contrast because Christ redeems our suffering. He does not recoil from it. He does not stigmatize us because of it. He does not criticize or blame us. He does not pity us. He calls us sons and daughters. He restores our identity. He offers us shalom. He gives us the hope of the resurrection. He heals our brokenness, and we call it, in our faith, the restoration of all things that begins right now. Oh, do you need that this morning? Does someone close to you need that this morning? One last thought for a minute and a half. I'm intrigued by the hymn. I really am. Where might we find his hem these days? How might we slip up behind him today and touch him ever so gently for healing? The ancient Celtic Christians believed in what they called thin places, geographic locations where the physical and the spiritual are in such close proximity that it's as though there is the thinnest of veils between the two. And the Celtic Christians called those thin places, places where we might touch the hem of God. Friends, the waters of Christian baptism were such a place for me at one time in my life, where I felt like the divine and the physical became so close together that it was the thinnest of veils. So much more happened than me getting wet that day. It's as though I touched God in a unique way. Sometimes I'm standing at the back and I'm lighting a candle just from time to time. When I have no words and I don't have an eloquent prayer to say, but someone is on my heart or my mind and I just light a candle. Sometimes in that spot I feel like there is a thin place and I'm touching the hem of Jesus. But week by week, when I come to this place, and I step out from my seat, which is usually over here somewhere, and I step out to receive the Lord's Supper. And I put my hands out like this, and somebody graciously puts bread in my hand, and I get to dip it in the cup. Oh, when I dip that bread in the cup, it's as though I am touching the hem. The hem of Jesus. And I sit back down and I watch you come. And like some in the crowd that day might have noticed this woman that they should have all been pushing to the side, they saw her come and brush up against him. I see you come and brush up against him. And when we come to these places by faith, we become freed from the destructive power of our suffering. And we'll do that again in a few moments. Let me pray for us. Father, there are some here right now for whom these are difficult days of suffering. We have all faced them. We will face them again. Grant us the grace to face it not with fatalism, not with coldness, and certainly not in our own strength, but to realize there is grace and hope and healing and freedom in Jesus. May we be freed from our suffering today because of him. And in his name we pray. Amen.